Today's episode is brought to you by Musical Theater Radio's merch store. Looking for that perfect gift for someone or just want to treat yourself to some great musical theater themed merch? Head to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the All Things Theater button on the homepage and check out all the different designs available. And now, today's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. Now, some of you might wonder, how do I find my guests? Well, sometimes they reach out to me, sometimes I reach out to them. But many of my great guests have been introductions by Mary Miko at Goodspeed Musicals in Connecticut, including today's guests. I just wanted to give a shout out to Mary, who has been a huge supporter of what I've been doing at the radio station and podcast first. Well, today's guest is a composer, author, vocal coach, music director, pianist, educator, and spent some time at Goodspeed as their assistant music director. Let's dive right in and learn more about him and his career and welcome Ted Kochelek to the program. Hello, Ted.
Hello, Jean-Paul. It's good to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you for coming on. Now, before we get into, you know, all about you, I always ask for a 30-second bio of my guests. So who is Ted in 30 seconds?
Ted is a musical theater writer with a grand passion for musical theater, or theater in general. I've devoted my life to the creation of musical theater, whether it's been as a musician, music director, as in the credits you've noted, educator, and also as a writer. As a composer, librettist, sometime lyricist. It all sluices into the same pool, Jean-Paul, you know, but it's part of that large, grander passion of musical theater, which has been something I've been deeply entrenched with since I was a boy.
I'm always curious. Yeah, you say you enjoyed music theater as a kid. When do you remember your first instant going, ooh, I really like this?
Oh, I know exactly what it was. I mean, I grew up in a family atmosphere that was exposed to all the great middlebrow, mid-century, 20th century culture. And I use middlebrow in the best possible sense of the word, entertainment with an idea. And that included the heavy hitters like the Rodgers and Hammerstein canon, Music Man. So opera, because I was trained classically from the time I was four, I believe, as a classical musician, and studied till I was about 16. So I was exposed to classical music and to opera and its, you know, various subsets, and grew up in that atmosphere, although I was not as deeply involved in musical theater as I am now. But the telling moment, the I can do moment, I remember exactly. When I was, I believe I was 12, 11 or 12, my mother took me to the movies. And before we saw the main feature, there was a short called Barbara in Movieland. And it was the filming of the Don't Rain on My Parade number at the Hoboken Terminal in New Jersey. Oh. With the direction of it and the staging and the shot of it. And that's the very first time I probably heard Streisand, I mean, in any very immediately impactful way. And certainly I know it was the first time I heard Don't Rain on My Parade. And that number made the hackles on the back of my neck stand up. It was so thrilling and electric with its animal magnetism, you know, and excitement and energy. That was my I can do that. How I was going to do that, I don't think I had formulated for myself, whether it was going to be as a musician, as an actor, as a writer, but I knew that this was the path for me. And really that was the telling moment.
So you've always wanted to do this, it seems, right from that moment.
Yeah, I mean, almost from the very beginning. And having grown up, and it was just an expansion of it, you know, into really diving into the whole history of musical theater, not just, you know, the couple of LPs in my parents' stereo cabinet, you know, really, really devoted myself and going to the public library and taking out cast albums and scores. I mean, that's how I really learned, by taking out, let's say, The King and I, and my sisters and I would record the whole Small House of Uncle Thomas ballet using pot lids for cymbals. I mean, that's how enamored of it I was, and so passionate about it. You know, sitting, reading through and recording all the entire score of Fiddler on the Roof. And what I loved so much about it was the exposure of the different cultures, you know, the South Asian culture of The King and I, the shtetl life of Fiddler. It was such a learning experience, historical. 1776, Oklahoma, all these historical stories are given a context of history that were so educational in learning about one's world and the legacy and the tradition and the heritage that the musical theater provides us as a reflection of America.
Very cool. I'm always curious. If in an alternate timeline, if you hadn't gone into this, was there another career path? You somewhere in the back of your mind, you thought, maybe I could have done this.
Well, I almost joined the seminary fresh out of grammar school. And obviously there is a corollary between religion and the theater, the ritual aspect of it, the celebrant aspect of it. I grew up in a rather religious atmosphere at home, and it seemed like a natural step. I was influenced by priests who I served as an altar boy, who taught in our schools, who I would go on house calls during the Christmas holidays. It was an opportunity to get out of school. I was influenced by it. You know, it was deep in my background. So I really seriously thought I might go after grammar school. And one of the priests, a younger priest in our parish, counseled me. And so I thanked the day he told me this. He said, wait till after high school. If you have a vocation, you'll know it then. And those were the wisest words that could have ever been told me and the correct way to go. And then once I went to high school, I went to an all-boys prep school. My second mentor there, Harry Dawson, with whom I've written Scaramouche, was also a very great big influence on me in a very humanitarian way and showing me the world, giving me a glimpse of what life had to offer in the arts, in cuisine, in all sorts of things. So that was a way of opening up the world to me that I said, well, is it going to be the cloth or is it going to be the curtain? And the curtain won out. Nice. And the other thing I think probably, because again, I think they're connected with the theater and spiritual, with the theater and religion is psychoanalysis, which of course one brings into bear when one is creating characters and dealing with subtext and motivation and behavior. So again, it all kind of sluices into the same pool, you know?
Exactly. So what did you after high school, where did you go? Did you go somewhere to study theater or what did you do?
No, I didn't. What I did was I joined or was invited to join a community theater. I had made their acquaintance when they were doing shows at different New Jersey community theaters when I was 16. I was the music director. I was the pianist, basically, you know, playing Roar the Grease Paint and Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. So I joined them and then they opened up their own theater. And I worked with them and stayed as their house music director for about 2.5-3 years. And we worked 365 days a year. If we weren't rehearsing, we were performing. We were doing midnight shows. I was acting. I did Nick and Virginia Woolf. I did Jerry and the Zoo Story. I directed a production of Trouble in Tahiti. And of course, I was the house music director. So we did everything from Gypsy to Night Music to Candide. It was an incredible learning experience, you know, and being able to have this group of very talented people week to week, just working constantly. It was quite an experience. I've never had another one like it. And with my prep school years, that community playhouse, Celebration Playhouse, as it was called, those are the two really seminal experiences of my life, formative experiences of my life that have carried me through my life.
That's very, very cool. Yeah, and you're right. All those things you did, the directing, the acting, all of that, it's also important when you're writing. you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even as a vocal coach, I mean, you discover what problems that actors have to solve when they're interpreting a piece of material, how they're going to activate it. And that helps you then when you're creating material to be able to say, is this playable by an actor? What can an actor do with this? Or is it inert? You know, is there nothing for them to play here? Is it just descriptive poetic passages, but nothing of substantial action and behavior? It really all does come down to that one important word, action. Action, 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 whether in text, whether in the songs themselves, and the through line of that action. And then after, when I was at Celebration Playhouse, unbeknownst to us, we were one of the first people to do Mac and Mabel after its Broadway run. We may have been the first or second, you know, stock house that did it. And unbeknownst to us, Michael Stewart, author of Hello Dolly and the book to Mac and Mabel, came to see us. And the next day, out of the blue, we got this great telegram, you know, loved the show from every note of Ted's Overture to whatever it is, you know, the last closing moments. And with that, when I Love My Wife opened on Broadway and I saw it, I think within the year, that was another, I want to do that moment. I wanted to be part of that band on stage. I was too young at that time to be one of the actual band members on stage, but I ended up doing the second piano book off stage and then helmed various stock productions at Kenleyland, you know, in Akron. And then I helped Cy as the music director in Chicago at the Drury Lane. And then finally, I guess I grew into it. My baby face got a little bit more weathered, and they let me do the national tour with the Smothers Brothers in 1979 and 1980. So I got to do that. So I really lived with I Love My Wife for a good 2 to 3 years following my community theater days, you know.
Well, No, go on.
Oh, and I was going to say that led directly to Barnum, because Cy did Barnum. The show had just opened by the time I returned from the national tour of I Love My Wife. And so I was asked to take part as one of the assistant box pianists. If you remember, the two pianists sat in the boxes overlooking the stage, and I would pinch hit for either one of those box pianists and occasionally conduct and sub for Peter Howard and his assistant. So again, you know, a utilitarian, all-embracing experience of musical theater.
I'm glad you brought up I Love My Wife, because that's one of my favorite cast recordings. I love the songs to that. And Cy Coleman is probably my favorite standalone composer. I love his work and just the variety of stuff. So just the fact that you got to work on both of those things, work with him, is just, I was like, oh, wow.
Well, and even more, and it's not a show everyone, or very few people know.
Yeah.
There was a review he did with Joe Layton in Chicago called Chicago, S-H-E-C-H-E-O. Okay. And it was modeled after the Crazy Horse Saloon in Paris. Hmm. In other words, there were semi-naked girls and magic acts and semi-naked girls and Cy Coleman songs and semi-naked girls and dance sequences. And I really got to work with Cy closely on that. I was sort of his liaison, because he was in New York, I was in Chicago. And even though it was all pre-recorded tracks, I still had to get some of the dance arrangements made and supervise and huddle and, you know, be the liaison with Joe Layton and Cy. So again, I was really thrown into it. And that's where I really got to work with him intimately. Even I remember one incident where he was at I don't think it exists anymore, but the Mayflower Hotel, he was staying there. And he had written some lyrics for a song. And I don't think it's something he did with great regularity. And once we were having a discussion about, you know, what he wanted me to do. And he very sweetly solicited my opinion about those lyrics. And he was so vulnerable about it. And I was so touched by that. It was that he would solicit my opinion and make himself so available, mm-hmm. you know, to say, what do you think of this? And happily, I loved the lyrics. I really did. You know, and I maybe had one or two, you know, comments to offer, you know, as an adjustment. But for the most part, I thought it was terrific. So it was a great experience. And unfortunately, I never got to work with him after that because I started doing my own shows and, you know, that whole process and all of that. But working with Cy was a great experience.
I love hearing stories like that. You hear the names, right? They're the upper echelon of the musical theater world, but I love hearing personalized stories like that because we always forget they're human, just like
absolutely.
Us.
They
have their worries and fears of what.
Of course.
And I love hearing that stuff. So when what was that moment when you decided to start writing stuff for yourself?
Well, again, one was always looking for, I was looking for a property that I could musicalize. You know, there's always the question of rights and royalty and all of that kind of stuff. So it's like, okay, where is this gonna come from? I mean, I had written children's theater things. I'd been commissioned for a children's opera that was done at Teapot in Philadelphia. But I really wanted to do a Broadway entertainment, you know, a first-class musical theater piece. Mm-hmm. And couldn't find anything. And then in 1982, I was wrapping up Barnum. And I was at the now defunct Coliseum Books at 57th and Broadway. And just, you know, browsing through the stacks, as I always like to do. And a cover caught my eye of a book called Marked by Fire, which was marketed as young adult fiction. You know, I looked at the cover, read the little précis, a gift from God given back. And that just blew me away. Gift from God given back. I didn't buy the book that day. I didn't buy it. That weekend, there was a review of the book in the Times. And I said, this is a sign. So I went back, I bought it, and thus began the process of transforming Marked by Fire into Abyssinia. I did not have a collaborator at that time. So I kind of, at first, I thought it was going to be maybe sort of a one-act expanded children's piece or, you know, a youth piece. Mm-hmm. And so I basically wrote a one act. I think I did a handful of songs, the majority of which still exist in the score today. And then I put it away for a couple of years. And I felt I really needed to get a real, another book writer with me to work on this and collaborate. And during that course, at some point, that's when I was doing Chicago. I answered an ad my now collaborator, Jim Ratcheff, had placed looking for a collaborator as well. And so I responded to that ad when I was back in the city. We met. He proposed a couple projects. We didn't necessarily agree on those, but he decided to come aboard with Abyssinia. And, you know, for the next year and a half, we wrote it. And then we presented it to, I literally walked off the street and left it on the desk at Musical Theater Works. And they took it on. Wow. And they had a tripartite process there of reading, stage greeting, and black box production. And that was our first production and my first musical produced in 1987 at what is now what has always been CSC, but they rented at that space to produce Abyssinia there. That was picked up by Goodspeed. They did it over the next 20 years, three times, twice at Chester, once at the main stage, which is how I got to know Mary when we were at Chester. And that was the beginning. That piece was the beginning. And, you know, then of course there are a lot of false starts, or you start projects that look positive, but then you can't get your mitts around some aspect of it. A style concern, a subplot concern, you can't get the rights, whatever it might be, you know, the usual stories, the usual obstacles. Then a mutual friend of my partner's and mine proposed The Age of Innocence as a sort of opera. And I really wasn't interested in writing an opera, but I looked at the script and, you know, I thought if I ever set this to music, it would be longer than Wagner's Ring. It was, you know, the entire novel on stage.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, no, this this just isn't for me. But the thing is, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And Walter Holland, who was the conceiver of it as a musical theater piece, you know, had spotted several songs amidst the treatment that really registered with me. And, you know, I did one or two of them and it started to take. And unlike Abyssinia or Marked by Fire, where I knew from the day one I read it on the page what the piece was going to be about, that all-important spine, from day one I knew what that was in Abyssinia. It took me maybe a couple of years to find that in the Age of Innocence. In other words, what does this story mean to me personally? I mean, I knew straight it was a great story. It's a wonderful novel, a classic American novel of letters, you know, letters, Pulitzer Prize winner. And there were challenges in how to transform this from the page to the stage. You know? And though I did not see it as an opera, I did see it as a operetta, meaning a lot of music. given the milieu, the period romance of the story, a lot of opportunity for more legit music, far a completely different cry from Abyssinia, which is sort of a Broadway, you know, pop, gospel-y kind of thing. I mean, it's first and foremost a theater score, but it has gospel inflection, blues inflection, ragtime inflections. But first and foremost, it's a theater score. Same thing with Age of Innocence, except that it had a more cultivated musical language, let's say, by virtue of its milieu and the romance at the heart of its story, the bittersweet romance at the heart of its story. Shall I keep on going?
No, that, well, I'm always curious about what works you've been working on, because anything else you've got going
well
in.
Yes,
there's always something, all right.
There's always something. I mean, of course, in the meantime, one has to support oneself. So I worked as a vocal coach. Jim Ratchef and I, who I did Abyssinia with, we also did many industrial musicals for the now defunct National Westminster Bank. And they gave us pretty much free rein to write anything. So we wrote these little book musicals singing the glories of branch managing. And you know, it was not only profitable, but fun to do, you know. and there's also, you know, songs for this and that, or we were commissioned to write a play for Japan.
You can't leave us hanging on that one.
Well, you know, it's so long ago, and it was kind of unsatisfactory. We got a commission to write a play around three performers who happen to be musicians. I don't remember the details. This is going back probably 30 years now, maybe not so long, but quite a long time ago. It seemed to me that the story that they wanted was out of sync with what the performers, who the performers were, their personas, and the instruments they played. It was putting square pegs in round holes. Yeah. And so I felt that we were sort of working at cross purposes. I mean, everyone was extremely congenial when we would get to talk with them about the progress of it. But I never really felt it was something we really nailed down 100%. Apparently it got produced and apparently everybody liked it enough. So I never saw it, and that was the end of it. I've never heard of it since. But that
brings up an interesting point of people who aren't theater people wanting something done and not understanding, you know, necessarily what works and what doesn't. And that's,
I mean, I believe they were a theater producing company in Japan. Okay. I'm not out to knock anybody, but it was more about what they wanted to, how they wanted to package the performers in a particular story that seemed to be at odds with the, as I said earlier, the performers themselves. Yeah. I don't remember much about it, but
that's okay.
It's there.
It, you know, it's part of your past, which you build on.
Exactly.
And you take the experience, and you, which is,
well, I'm a big believer in nothing is wasted. I tell my coaching students this. You know, It doesn't matter whether, you know, the audition didn't get you the job. The fact is, you learned by going into that audition hall, trying out new material, trying out a new interpretation, getting over your stage fright, whatever it is, it all adds up to your experience, you know, so that you walk in with technique and confidence, right? Not arrogance, but confidence that you know what you're doing. Yeah. You know, and if you've done that job, then you can go home and have your martini. You know, you've accomplished the goal for that day, right? I did want to elaborate on my most recent project, which probably has the most fascinating gestation period of all, genesis of all. As I mentioned earlier, I went to a prep school, and one of my teachers, their English humanities teacher, Harry Dawson, who I mentioned earlier, he became a mentor, and as I said, he gave me life lessons, okay, in culture and in the art. And once I left school, knowing my career goals in musical theater, he suggested the novel Scaramouche by Raphael Sabatini from early 1920s, I believe 21, as the basis of a libretto. And this would have been in the mid 70s, right? So the project almost immediately fell by the wayside because he was still committed to a full caseload of teaching, and I was embarking on my musical theater career. But for the next, we continued discussion about this show over the next 50 years. And accruing literally a shopping bag full of musical sketches, lyric sketches, ideas, thematic concerns, all of it. I mean, we would swap back and forth once every decade.
Yeah.
I tried to find other people to work on it with me. I couldn't find anyone. So it sat, you know, in the shopping bag for a very long time until about 2010. And I don't remember exactly what galvanized me at this time. I was probably in between projects, but I said, let me pull this piece out and see what's here. And I remember I was as enamored as of it as I'd always been. So I started to do the first draft of it. But after a while, I felt that there were too many questions I could not answer for myself. There were too many dramatic conundrums, thematic concerns at cross purposes. And I said, if I can't answer these questions for myself, I'm not going to be able to answer them for anyone else. So back into the drawer it went until 2020. And we have George Floyd, and we have protests in the streets, and we've got Trump, and we've got the 1% versus the disenfranchised, and a whole revolutionary fervor in the air that made me think, well, French Revolution, Scaramouche, let me pull this out again. And whatever questions or conundrums I had confronted 10 years prior seemed to disappear. Whatever questions I had were no longer issues. The problems that I couldn't work out solved themselves or were no longer problems. And I was able to do a, you know, rough, completed, let's say, complete first draft as opposed to an incomplete. And at that point, I knew I needed to bring a lyricist aboard. And so, of course, I tapped Jim and we started working in February of 21. And by February of 23, we have a second full draft, a complete score, and we're now developing it toward production, knock wood. You know, so, but it's a process that literally has sat on the back burner for half a century. But again, it's like, it's because I knew there was something there. If I didn't believe in it so fervently, if that commitment to it wasn't there, I would have forgotten about it. You know, but I thought that there was something there and I responded to it. And you know, the actual writing of the score in the past 2 years has been one of the most joyous, liberating experiences I've had. It was like, you know, honey pouring out of the keyboard or the word processor. I cook, so that so I mean, it was like honey. It was just, I mean, it's always work, but there's work and then there's work.
Yeah.
And here I just felt I was, both Jim and I were in the zone, so to speak, in the zone. And it, you know, and then pretty much after that, we started, you know, having a table read, and that went very well. And now we'll see what happens. All this is fairly recent. So we have to see what happens next.
It's crazy that, you know, art and artists, we can let something sit for 50 years and it's still as fresh or as new and as exciting. You can't, how many other industries can you do that? It's not like tech, definitely. Right. 50 years ago, like things like that. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, even something like Abyssinia. I mean, Abyssinia had certain conundrums of its own that we had to. I mean, it always played well. It was very successful with audiences. We broke box office wherever we went. Reviews were generally very, very favorable. But we knew that there were certain things we couldn't just figure out. You know, what's the solution to this particular problem?
Yeah.
And you know, it's the thing, we're not sausage factories. You just can't grind it out. And some things take their own time. And so finally, it wasn't until I went up to Hackney Empire in London in 2017, and we did a workshop of it there, that I felt that those questions, those conundrums I've mentioned earlier, finally sorted themselves out. But that was after how long? 30 years? You know, and we did many drafts in between, and all of them were viable. Yeah. All of them were viable. They all played. And some of the changes were basically cosmetic. As I said, the spine of the piece was always there. And I think that's one of the reasons we were able to continue to work on it, because it was, to me, the story was like a fascinating bauble. You turn the prism or the kaleidoscope one way, and there's a different angle you could take, because we were dealing with myth. And myth is a deep wellspring. I mean, as a matter of fact, I like to think that all the musicals I've worked on have a mythic structure to them. Abyssinia, Age of Innocence to a certain extent, and certainly Scaramouche, all sort of have a Campbellian structure of myth that is a subtext to the work. It gives you a grounding, you know, into the eternal verities.
Nice. Well, Ted, thank you for coming on today and introducing yourself to me and the listeners and everything. How can people learn more about what you do and your shows and things like that?
They can certainly go to my website, which is all encompassing. That's tedkocielek.com. That's TEDKOCIOLEK.com. And you'll learn what's new, what's happening. There's demo recordings of my shows there, information about them, my resume, if you're so inclined. A lot of information you can glean from my website.
That's awesome. And you sent me a few of the songs, which we added to the rotation of Scaramouche and
excellent
Innocence, because, you know, they sound great. And
thank you.
Let's let other people learn about them and listen to them. And
please, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. It's, you know, I could talk about, you know, early 80s Broadway shows and stuff like that forever. And you know, maybe we'll have people on and do a roundtable of, you know, what it was like to work, you know, with some of these people and things mm-hmm. like that. So congratulations on everything you've done, everything you accomplished. And I look forward to hearing where all the stuff is going. And when Scaramouche reaches its next level, please let us know. And we'll
absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for this platform.
Yeah, it's been great. All right. We were just speaking with Ted Kocielek here on the station. Tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion that is musical theater. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.